is Adam. Welcome back to Bringing It Backwards, a podcast where both legendary and rising artists tell their own personal stories of how they achieve stardom. On this episode, we had a chance to hang out with Aaron Pauly of the band Of Mice and Men over Zoom video. Aaron was born and raised just outside of San Francisco in the Bay Area, and he talks about how he got into music. He talks to us about the early bands he played in, joining the Sacramento band Jamie's Elsewhere, the success that band had, and how he eventually joined Of Mice and Men. He talked about a turning point for Of Mice and Men, some of the huge tours they had a chance to be a part of, and a lot about this brand new record called Echo, which started out as three EPs, and the way they went about it, and how the pandemic affected the record. He talks all about it. And you can watch the interview with Aaron on our Facebook page and YouTube channel at Bringing It Backwards. It'd be awesome if you subscribe to our channel, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Bringing Back Pod. And if you're an Amazon shopper, a portion of your everyday purchases will help support our podcast with just a few clicks. It's super easy. Please head over to our website, bringingitbackwards.com, and click on Amazon each time you begin your purchases. Those few extra clicks will help keep our mission of providing a platform for both legendary and rising artists to tell their personal stories on how they achieve stardom so that all artists and music enthusiasts have access to meaningful and memorable advice that will help inspire their own musical journeys. To recap, please head over to bringingitbackwards.com and click on Amazon before you make each and every purchase, because a portion of that purchase will add up in a big way to help support our mission. Thank you so much.
We'd appreciate your support if you follow and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're Bringing It Backwards with Of Mice and Men. My name's Adam, and this is about you and your journey in music.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the new record with Of Mice and Men as well.
Perfect.
Sweet. I did read from Vacaville.
Yep.
Born and raised?
Most of my life there. Born in Walnut Creek.
So, oh, really? I lived in Walnut Creek for a bit.
Nice, yeah. I was born there, moved to Vacaville, I think, when I was 2 years old. Moved to Clear Lake when I was 10 or no, I was probably 11 or 12, and then moved back maybe a couple years later for ninth grade.
Okay.
Then lived in Vacaville until I moved down to Huntington Beach several years back.
Right on. Right on. How did you get into music?
Music was a big part of our family. Like our family listened to a lot of music. My dad was a musician. His dad was a musician.
Oh, wow.
I first got into music, though, from the school band. I went to a private school, and in third grade, you could choose either, I don't even remember what the alternative was. It was either band or something else. I want to say maybe it was like science class or something, which is a weird, which is a weird choice. But
right. I was going to say that's a,
I remember that the choice was, yeah, it was like, it was either band or like do labs or something. And
it wasn't like chorus or.
No. It wasn't between two different band. I honestly think it was either band or another PE class. I mean, I can't remember. I was in third grade.
Sure. you decided to go with band. That's all.
Yeah. So I wanted to play the drums. So that was my first instrument.
Okay. So you picked up drums.
Yep.
So a full kit, or do you start off on like a snare?
Oh no! When you're in third grade, they give you just a snare drum. Well, first they give you a recorder, and you have to just learn the. You learn Mary Had a Little Lamb on the little plastic
like hot cross buns.
Yeah, and then and then it was a snare drum, and then actually before I got a full drum set, I got moved to auxiliary percussion, which is things like timpani, and. Bell and like xylophone and stuff, and I know I did that for years, but I have very little memory of it.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you play through like middle school and high school in the school band?
I did a little bit in middle school, I think for maybe one semester or two, and then my middle school did this weird thing. So the middle school in Clear Lake I went to was 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and there was this weird thing that happened. Right after, it was like halfway through my 7th grade year, the school decided, oh, we're going to do two different lunch periods now. Yeah, which is very strange because all of my friends ended up getting in a completely different lunch period than me. And the band class that I would have been in was right before that lunch period, and I couldn't do that because that would have been my lunch period. So that was when I stopped doing music.
Oh my gosh.
and if memory serves correctly, that only lasted, I think, for that semester, because I don't recall that happening the year afterwards. But then again, like I said, I have very few memories of like 5 years old up until last week.
So on playing drums, did you play in a band as a middle school, high schooler?
No. So basically I drums was my first instrument. I got my first drum kit when I was, I want to say I was maybe 7 years old or so. And at the time I was doing Taekwondo at the same time, cause that was like another little kid thing that I really wanted to do. I wanted to play a drum set and I wanted to be like the Three Ninjas. If you remember that movie.
Oh, I love that movie.
And so
the masks.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So basically my folks said, you know, if you, around the time I was maybe like 8 or 9, my folks were like, you know, if you can do this Taekwondo thing till you get your black belt, we'll get you a guitar. And so then I ended up getting my black belt and they got me a guitar. I never did play drums in any band that I was ever in. Mm-hmm. Not even the middle school ones. By then I'd switched to guitar and I'd really fallen in love with guitar.
Wow. How old were you when you got your black belt?
10 or 11, maybe.
Wow. That's fast, right? I mean, I don't know much about
I suppose
martial arts.
I remember my, like I said, it's really hard. Like I know that I did these things, but it's really hard for me to close my eyes and remember them.
Sure.
I remember that I was good at it though. And I used to do really well in the tournaments because I used to have a bunch of trophies from like sparring and stuff. And then I remember my dad used to, he used to stop home on the way from work and he'd get like a 6-inch, you know, pine boards or whatever. And we had a bunch of them in the garage. And even before I had to for class, I was already learning how to break boards and stuff.
Oh, wow.
I don't remember. I couldn't do any of it now. I mean, I'm sure I could break those boards. They're not tremendously hard to break, but
you haven't brushed up on your karate skills.
No, I don't remember lately. I don't remember any of the forms or techniques. I do remember though, there was like two different variations of Taekwondo, forms that you could do, you know, like essentially your movement forms. And I remember my school taught one and there was another school in town that taught another way. And I remember I bought a book and learned how to do both of them. And I didn't retain any of that. I mean, I'm sure it's in there somewhere, but I don't have the software to go and get that out the old Rolodex, you know.
You said dad and your grandpa were musicians as well?
Yeah, so my dad is a amazing singer. He's also an amazing painter. And my grandfather was also a singer. He was actually in a band that toured and put out a vinyl record back in the day and everything.
That's cool. Do you have a copy of it?
I do. I don't have it handy, though.
But that's rad. That's so cool.
Yeah.
And your dad,
I only learned that like maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
Really?
I never knew that. I knew that my grandpa sang in a barbershop quartet, mm-hmm. or he sang in a trio rather. But I never knew that it was that serious, that there was actually a vinyl record that exists.
That's cool. That's cool that you have a copy of it. So what you said, you got a guitar when you got the black belt, and then do you immediately just immerse yourself in playing guitar?
Yeah, very heavily. I remember I took 2 or 3 guitar lessons, but I remember and I'm sure this has to do with having ADHD, but I just remember that I really wanted to learn what I wanted to learn, and anything that wasn't explicitly what I wanted to learn, I had a very hard time sitting through any kind of instruction. It was the same way in school. Uh-huh. I was very, very heavily interested and could focus very intently on the things that I was interested in, but... yeah, there was, you know, a couple of chord progressions and scales and things, and it was like, nah. But then he showed me how to play a couple of, I want to say it was Lynyrd Skynyrd songs, like Sweet Home Alabama and Freebird. And wow. I just remember learning those and sort of, my brain sort of broke down the scales and everything that I should have learned is fundamentally, my brain kind of wrapped itself around the idea of learning songs and breaking them down that way. So I became very interested in that.
Were you songwriting young as well?
I'm sure that I was. I can remember being young and recording like a bar or two of something on a little tape recorder, but no, nothing like, I mean, composing songs like a child, compose songs, I guess. Yeah. Nothing long form or that exists.
Okay. Were you in a band in high school then?
Yeah, I was in several bands, just mostly with friends, performing in like the Sacramento area, Bay Area, up until I was, you know, in my early 20s when I joined Jamie's Elsewhere, which was a band from Sacramento. And that's when I started like touring.
Okay. How did you meet them? How did you join that band?
Just from playing locally, I'd known a lot of the people in the proverbial scene, if you will.
Okay, sure.
And yeah, they had lost their singer, and I was kind of in between a few different projects. At the time, I remember I used to like just do a lot of music with a lot of different people. And then, yeah, they'd actually reached out to me, and I just tried out. And then, fall 2008, we left for our first cross-country tour. Well, it was my first cross-country tour as far as playing the far coasts. I toured once in 2006, made it as far as Oklahoma, I think, which is pretty far. It's about halfway.
That is pretty far, yeah. Was that with a different band?
It's about halfway. Yeah. It was with a local band.
Okay. What was it like doing that first big tour?
It was a lot of fun. It was definitely hectic. There was definitely a learning curve of, you know, how to survive off $5 a day per diems. how not to freeze if you're going to attempt to live in a van and you're touring in winter. Because you think, oh, I'm inside a van, like snow can't get me. And it's like, no, you can definitely still freeze in a van. but it was great learning, you know, kind of being able to travel around the different spots sort of before, you know, Twitter and Instagram and all of these things sort of started sprouting up where the scene was still very localized and very unique kind of per region that you visited before everything kind of got a little bit more homogenous with social media. But that's actually one thing I really remember was sort of seeing, going to different towns and seeing what bands' shirts everybody was wearing and the records they were talking about and how, you know, the scene could be super connected, but at the same time, you know, bands on the or fans on the East Coast would be listening to something completely different than fans on the West Coast. Whereas now, you know, it's largely based around social media and then meeting up. So everything's a little bit more homogenous.
Yeah, a totally different way to discover probably bands for you. I mean, go to the East Coast and you're like, oh, what band shirt are you wearing? And then maybe you pick a record up or whatever.
Yeah, and a lot of the shows we would have local openers and stuff and just really getting sort of a building up your sort of lexicon for seeing how different areas also kind of sound different and how regionally the stuff you grow up with can really affect your songwriting and whatnot. That was a really cool experience, I remember.
That's cool. And was that a tour that you guys booked yourself or were you on because that band was signed to Victory, right?
Yeah. It was with another Victory band. It was with a band called Four Letter Lie, which Modson, the artist known as Modson, I knew him when he was the drummer of Four Letter Lie on that tour, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really funny.
Okay.
But and I remember him showing us like some of the very first Modson stuff on that tour. But no, we were with a booking agency and with a management company, I think, in 2008. And then we had split with them in 2009. Okay. I say everything with a question mark because it's just, you got to give me like roughly. A plus or minus 2 years on each end, you know?
All right. No worries. when you joined Jamie's Elsewhere, were you guys signed to Victory at that point? Or
yeah. So the band was signed and they'd already put out one full length.
Okay.
And I joined, I think, for the second tour of that full length. It was me and a new bass player that had joined at the time.
Okay. And you did that for a few, couple of years. You did what, two records with them?
Yeah. So we did one full length. I did the Reimagined EP. Mm-hmm. And then that was until spring 2012 and that's when I actually started working with the Mice guys. We actually played a show, Jamie's Elsewhere and Of Mice and Men, in Bakersfield. I want to say it was in March of 2012 at a mall,
Really?
At like a mall food court, at like a mall slash flea market type deal. And I'd known the guys from like previous bands. Like I'd known Phil actually because I toured with Phil, our guitar player, back when he was in A Static Lullaby. I toured with him in November and December of 2008.
Oh, okay.
And then I'd known the Lower D guys after Tino, our drummer, was he used to be in that band. But then I knew the other guys, so I sort of knew him by proxy. We knew a lot of the same people, and we were friends with a lot of the same people. But yeah, we played that show. We were direct support for them, and they headlined at the time. They had a guy named Joel who was filling in for bass and vocals, and they were getting ready to do Warped Tour that summer. Uh-huh. Actually, if I remember correctly, shortly after that Bakersfield show, they were getting ready to go to Europe for a month. And then they said after that, well, Joel had told me, he said, you know, I'm not going to Europe with the guys, and I don't think I'm going to do Warped Tour either. You should talk to him. Mm-hmm. And I was already kind of doing my own thing, so it wasn't really much of a thought. But at the end of the night, I was talking with Tino, and I said, hey, you know, Joel told me that he's not going to be doing Warped with you guys. And I made a joke. I said, hey, if you need somebody to just sing the clean parts underneath the stage or something, just holler at me. I'll sit under the stage and sing all those parts for you. And then he asked me, he said, do you play bass? And I said, well, I've never played bass in a band, but I play guitar. I've played guitar at that point. It was like 12 or 13 years. So I was like, you know, I play guitar, and I know for a lot of metalcore, it sort of translates one for one, you know, decently well. And so I said, you know, I could. And then he said, yeah, send over like a reel of just some of your stuff. And I just remember I composited like a little demo reel of, at the time I was still producing bands and stuff. I had a home studio set up, and I set up a demo reel and just fired it over. And he said, yep, everyone loves it. We'll be back after this Euro run, and we'll get working on the Warped Tour set. And then the rest is sort of history from there, because we really didn't stop. After that tour, I think I was home maybe for a month and a half over the course of the next like 12 to 18 months. So we were out, like we were just going.
Uh-huh. That must have been pretty life changing, I would imagine, because they were probably fairly big at that time, right?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. It was awesome. I remember, to me, it felt like a lot of hard work and preparation went into it. It sort of felt like it, you know, if there's a such thing as getting a break, that felt like the closest thing I'd ever experienced to getting any sort of break, especially, you know, being on a band that was on Victory Records. And they, you know, you can, anybody listening to this or watching this can just Google that. Because you can spend so much time, yeah, talking about that and just,
oh yeah,
their treatment of artists and whatnot. historically, you know,
sure.
We didn't get. I mean, let me clarify that nothing was horrible by any means, but there was definitely not a lot of love either from them or from the industry because we were associated with them at the time. So, Yeah,
there's a lot of, I remember all that drama that kind of happened with, I mean, a lot of those bands that were on Victory Records kind of got the short stick early on.
yeah. And it was all because of stuff that was way above our heads and
out of
grade.
Sure. Know? It's just like, oh, they've got all these other awesome bands. Why not like get involved with what they have going on?
Yeah. But no, there was like a definite blacklisting where basically the entire music community and booking agents and venues were like, yeah, we're not going to deal with it.
It's wow. Like,
okay. Fair enough. We released our record and then basically served them notice that we weren't going to look to exercise our option, and they had 30 days to respond, and they didn't, so we were off. So we had a clean break.
That's
nothing,
good.
Nothing too bad, but you know, in that time when there are definitely sort of machines and things that are sort of clicky happening, and you realize you're not on the inside, it gets a little frustrating. But you know, it was really cool when I started working with the mice guys. It was like they were very serious about what they did. They were very serious about you know, their business, about how seriously to take it, you know, because it just, everybody sort of recognized what the opportunity was, and everybody worked really, really hard. And that was very refreshing to sort of come into that camp and like, all right, let's get to work.
Because
when you wait for years and years and years and you tell yourself this is what you want to do, and then you get the chance to do it, it's like, oh, this is kind of all I want to do. And so, yeah, we got to work. We did the Warped Tour set, and I remember it was just awesome. Everything flowed really well. And then we were on main stage that year, which that was my first time ever playing Warped Tour.
Wow. And you got to play the main stage on your first time.
Yeah, and it was wild. I got to play the main stage sort of when Of Mice was kind of cresting a popularity wave at the time, if you will, you know. And it was really cool. All the fans were very accepting of me when they definitely didn't have to be.
That was my next question for you. Was it weird kind of stepping into that position?
Not really. You know, I always enjoyed playing. Like, I always, you know, I enjoy fronting a band, and that's fun in its own right. But I've always enjoyed playing live music, especially just having an instrument. Learning bass as its own actual instrument, not as just like, oh, we'll just do what the guitars do.
Right. just follow
but,
the root note.
But actually, learning all of that was a very, very rewarding experience. It definitely broadened my understanding of music and understanding of songwriting. And it's still it's still something I do on our records. I play the bass on all of our records, and I really, really enjoy it. I don't know if I'll do it live again, or if I'll do anything live again, if things keep going the way they're going.
Oh, I know. What a nightmare.
But no, it's cool. It was awesome, you know. And then the band made me an official member in, I want to say it was the following spring in 2013. We were in Europe. We were in somewhere in Switzerland, and I remember they pulled me in. They're like, "Hey, we just want to let you know you're in." I was like, "Sick." I already felt like I was in because we'd already logged probably 50,000 miles together.
but they made it official.
Yeah, but that was a very cool thing, and that was sort of when we started. Around that time, we all started getting to work on very early stage demos of what would eventually become a couple ideas on Restoring Force.
Oh, really? Okay. What was it like writing with them for the first time? Was that something you're worried about, or?
You know, initially it was just because I don't want to step on anybody's toes. I'm somebody that just inherently doesn't like conflict anyway. Like, so it's just kind of like, I will disengage before I enter conflict, you know? But I remember we started to do pre-production for the Restoring Force album. And it was just three of us that went to the studio. And I remember we were working with David Bendith. And I basically got the go-ahead from the guys, like, write stuff, you know, like, show us stuff you're writing. And I was kind of struggling, sort of not really knowing how far I wanted to spread my wings, if you will. Like, there's sort of a weird feeling about, like, well, I don't want to, like, I want to take flight, you know, but I don't want to, like, peacock around, you know. I don't want to, like, spread my wings a little too far.
Right.
When it's sort of my first endeavor. But, I remember that David Bendith, he was actually very encouraging. And I was actually having kind of a hard time because, at one point I felt like I had really bad imposter syndrome. I was just like, I finally got here. I finally got in the studio with David Bendith, and me being a producer at home, like producing local bands, David was like one of my heroes. He was somebody that the home recording community really looked up to just because of his productions, especially on the drums side. And I just remember finally being in his studio and being like, well, I got here and I realized I don't got what it takes, you know? And he basically told me to shut up and go to bed. And I remember I went to bed really sort of upset that night. The next morning I woke up and I started working on a song, and that song was Another You off of Restoring Force. That was the first piece of music I ever wrote for the band.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I'd got everything, basically the whole instrumental of the song done. And I sort of showed it to everybody. And yeah, everybody was excited about it. And excited that I had contributed that. And that was sort of the, you know, at least for me, that was sort of my go ahead to start feeling like I could really express myself without worrying about how I fit into it, you know, because ultimately that's what we've done every single record is mm-hmm. we just focus on really honestly trying to express whatever we're trying to express in song form. And we never complicate it beyond that. And how the albums will shape up and what that thread between the 10 songs or 11 or 12 songs, that all reveals itself in time. But like we always try and just really myopically focus on the exercise of honestly expressing yourself. And then it doesn't have to get super complicated, which that was actually what most of this new record that we just did was all about. Because we had basically decided right before the world changed drastically, we had decided that we were going to change what we did pretty drastically. Like, you know, when we had started meeting with labels after our Rise record contract was done mm-hmm. with the release of Earth and Sky, we basically were telling labels, you know, hey, we really want to release a body of work that we create over the course of a year, and we want to release it in the form of EPs and do something that's a little bit more episodic rather than the traditional album format. And there were a lot of labels that were kind of put off by that because mm-hmm. record labels like having solid first week numbers and like having the rollout and like having the album, you know, the album. It's the album. It's
right.
The album. Not that
which is interesting, right? Well, I guess if you're an established band, I mean, what you guys have, what, 7 records out now?
Yeah, and that's
so
and that's
they're the looking part. For the record. If you were a yeah. band that had an EP out, then they might be like, "Yeah, we'll just drop a few singles and kind of see how this thing rides." But yeah. it's like they know what to expect now.
Yeah, and you know, and Sharptone was actually really excited about the whole thing. And not just in a way to say like, yeah, you know, we'll sign you guys and we'll give you a budget and we'll allow you to do this. They were really excited about jumping on board and being creative partners in that. Because we don't always have a clear vision of what we want to do, but sometimes we do. And when we do, it's just, you know, we work really, really hard and really intently at that. Mm-hmm. But that was really what this new record was all about. It was just about writing 3 songs at a time and not biting off more than you can chew and not trying to think about how you're going to thread all these together in an album. Mm-hmm. But just trying to write 3 very genuine songs that expressed our thoughts and feelings and emotions and to not overcomplicate it. And that sort of gave us a lot of creative freedom because we weren't sort of constrained by the canvas shape of an album. You know, we didn't have to basically know what the boundaries were and then work our way in. We kind of got to start in the middle and just work our way out, and whatever the shape of the art ended up becoming, it was very organic that way. And it wasn't even until we had released the second EP that fans had started asking about, hey, is there going to be an album format of the 3 EPs where we can get them all in one place? And we had enough interest in that basically everybody sort of came together and we're like, okay, we'll figure out a way of, you know, not only just releasing all 3 EPs and releasing, because our goal was to release a new song every few weeks, to keep sort of us engaged, to keep the fans engaged. You know, our hope would be that it would give fans something to look forward to, but we knew it would always give us something to look forward to. You know, if a new song is dropping, that's very exciting to share. And it's one of the joys of creating music is then sharing your human experience with other people. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so, you know, we basically figured out that we were going to release the 3 EPs as an album. And then the very last song of the record dropped on the 3rd and it's been out. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty wild experience just in general, because there was so much more work that went into it than the initial thought of, oh, we'll just create, you know, we'll do an album's worth of material and we'll create three EPs. But it, you know, it ended up becoming an exercise, like four different exercises in creativity and sort of, you know, creating assets, creating music videos with the director Frankie Nasso, mm-hmm. off of the amazing artwork that Derek Hess was creating for the releases. It just became sort of a exercise after exercise after exercise of just exercising your creativity and working with other creatives and collaborating on a lot of really cool projects. Mm-hmm. Now that it's all said and done, I can definitely say it was a lot more work than we thought it was going to be, but it was awesome because we were able to release new music all year.
Uh-huh.
And we entirely self-made and self-produced the record. It was just the four of us.
Really?
Yeah.
Was it done like over Zoom or something?
It was done exactly like this.
Really?
Except wow. there were four squares, and we were working off of a lot of times we would write off of Alan's computer, and then he would send me the tracks, and I would basically pre-mix them, and then send them out to Tino and to Phil, and then, you know, they would send me their tracks. Tino would send me the drums and like some sound design stuff. I would record bass and vocals, and then I mixed and mastered it. And so it was, you know. It was the four of us.
Wow.
That's, I will really say, impressive. With the exception of one song, Pulling Teeth, which Rod Sudani of the band Volumes, the bass player, he plays bass for us when we play live.
Oh, does he? I've interviewed Volumes before. They're a good band.
He's one of my best friends. He's a great, great guy. And he actually co-wrote that song, Pulling Teeth. So it wasn't entirely just the four of us, but
one song.
Yeah, but as far as actually producing the record, as far as what you are listening to, you know, that was the four of us.
And I'm sure that's probably something you hadn't done before, right?
No, we'd never done that for a commercial release in this band. We've always done that with regard to our pre-production. Basically, anytime we've gone into a studio since Restoring Force, after having that initial Bendeth boot camp, you know, mm-hmm. Everything, almost every single record we had pre-produced in, you know, what I would consider in the 70th percentile of completed commercially, you know, mm-hmm. quality music, I guess, commercially releasable music. And it was sort of, we'd basically started pre-production on the first EP. And right around that time was when the first lockdown started. And also right around that time, our favorite recording studio nearby that we would record at, Hybrid Studios, which we did the Restoring Force Full Circle, like that sort of extended EP. I think it was four new songs. We did those there.
Okay.
And then we did all of the tracking with the exception of vocals and some guitars, I want to say, and overdubs at that studio for Earth and Sky. So that studio went on the market for sale. And we were like, okay, well, let's just do this. Like, let's basically push ourselves as far as we can go on the pre-production side. Let's get these songs as close to a commercially viable product as we can. Really, really take our time. And then, worst case scenario, we have really good sounding pre-pro before we go to the studio and redo the whole thing.
Right.
But no, I remember we turned in the first EP. The label heard it. They loved it. That whole week, I was sending mix and master revisions as I was doing them. You know, I would do it and feel like, oh, well, this one's just a little bit better, and I'd send that. And then a couple days later, I'd be like, oh, I think this one's a little bit better, and I'd send that. And finally, Sean Keith at Sharptone was like, this sounds awesome. Don't send me anymore. this is what we're putting out. It sounds great. And it was like, okay, awesome. Like, and that gave me a lot to work on, and it gave me a lot to look forward to. And it kept my mind busy at a time where, idle hands certainly wouldn't have done my mental health any good, you know?
Sure.
So that was a really, really cool process. I had mixed our Live at Brixton album and DVD. Mm-hmm. That was back in like 2016, and that was basically just remixing tracks from a mixed live show, so that wasn't, you know, necessarily the same thing, but
okay.
But no, it was really awesome, and it was really fun because it was the closest thing to getting back in the garage with your boys and just writing songs for the sake of writing songs. Like, not really, you can't put tons of expectations on yourself when you're purposely trying something different, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that's one of the benefits of sort of changing up the model and deciding that we're going to release EPs was we didn't really have any metric to gauge anything by, which is nice. If you can sort of get rid of all the metrics that you have in your brain, you can really sort of deconstruct a lot of the stuff that you kind of put in the way, if you will, and get back to a very sort of rudimentary and foundational way of writing songs. Because mm-hmm. back when you're working on your first material, you don't know anything about first week numbers or recouping a budget or all of this stuff that you sort of accumulate and you sort of predetermine what your songs have to do.
Right.
Which is kind of funny because when you're first starting out writing music, you don't think about any of that. Like, there is zero thought to any of that. And I think stripping all of that back, you end up, you know, we ended up finding that we put ourselves right back in a place where we were just chasing whatever inspired us in the moment. And we were just chasing these ideas that as we're jamming and we hear two pieces of noise come together and all of a sudden it's greater than the sum of its parts and everybody's ears perk up. And that's what we basically chased, was just the, yes, you know, the aha mm-hmm. moments. And it was really awesome. And it's, you know, it's, we got our first week numbers back. And it was, we almost doubled what we did in Earth and Sky in albums first week, which is wild, to think that we could sort of just, you know, sink a little further into ourselves and a little further into our process and really like distill, I guess, what makes us us, and then really kind of just focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool.
Yeah, that is. It's interesting that you guys kind of already had that mindset. Like, we're going to do this EP, the deal's up with Rise, and then the pandemic hit. So it kind of like allowed you to really dive into that.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, we had started working on Zoom and Dropbox. It almost worked out a little too perfectly because we had started working on it several weeks before there were any inclinations that anything was going to be shutting down. Like, we had just done Shiprocked in February, and then by uh-huh. March, everything's just locked down again. It's like we were on a cruise ship with thousands.
Oh my gosh.
Of people, you know? But, you know, we all live, we live a little bit further apart than would allow for us to just get together multiple times a week in any mm-hmm. location without, you know, stressing everybody's schedules. So we had already sort of made the commitment to working remotely and working diligently, because when you're working remotely, it is really easy to sort of lose track of your schedule. But part of us, you know, taking on the responsibilities of self-producing the record, responsibilities I took on mixing and mastering and whatnot, like it definitely gave a 9-to-5 feel to it, but in a way that's really, you know, it's kind of important, I think, especially if you're somebody who's been on the road for 10 years straight, essentially, and you're used to doing things a very certain way. And then, you know, to basically have the rug pulled out from under you, and it's like, okay, well, now you don't know what your next 2 years are going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Having something that intense, you know, having an elephant that big that you have to eat, And you know, the cliche goes, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Mm-hmm. Lots of bites, you know. So we were chewing for 12 months.
We were chewing.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the pandemic, or the fact that you guys were able to, you know, spend more time on it, do you feel like it affected the record at all? Or, I mean, it sounds like you had a lot of time to sit and tinker with the mixes and resend them and...
Oh, yeah.
Get to the point where you're like, okay, I just need to sit this thing down and not come back to it for a while.
Yeah. You know, you never finish a song. You just abandon it at some point, and then it gets and then it gets released. And I think a lot of people feel that way. And that's why live music is such a beautiful thing, because songs that you know and love are always played just slightly different live, because in the act of playing it live, you really sort of revisit a lot of things, and you will add things to the live performance that 6 months after release, you go, man, I wish I would have done that on the record, you know, and now you do it live basically every time you play it. So they get to sort of take on a life of their own. It gave us a lot of time to communicate what we were trying to express before we did it. Whereas a lot of times when you're in a studio and you have, you know, 8 weeks, you have 8 weeks to do 10 songs and you're like, that's not that big a deal. You can do a song or two a week, you know? But even just having that much of a time frame already creates just the stippling of a box, you know, that you're already going to put yourself in. So knowing that there wasn't going to be any touring and knowing that our only mission was to release 10 songs over the course of a year, it's funny because we worked just as hard, but it was sort of nice knowing that you weren't to any sort of really technically hard deadline. And we made all of our deadlines like it was nothing, because we were basically at that point. By the time the second EP was turned in, I was already just like in a groove working. Anytime there was a deadline date, it was like I had it ready the night before and all I had to do was send the email, and then it felt
there you go.
And then I'd realize like, oh shit, I forgot a song. Like, you know, but it was really awesome. It definitely was, you know, music and creating that record was sort of the, it was a plank in the ocean for us. You know, it gave us something to grab onto while we waited to figure out what was going to happen next.
For sure.
And knowing that it floats and knowing that we could all hold on to it, and it sort of got us through the year. And it also, you know, it gave us that connection that we seek. Like, we make music because we're human beings that just want to connect with people the same way that music fans do, because we are music fans. Like, first and foremost, I will say I'm a fan of music before I'll say I'm a musician, because music moved me long before I could ever create any of it. And it was really awesome to sort of do that and to sort of jump in the deep end with my brothers and just get into it. And I feel like what we were able to create is music that resonates really, really heavily with me. And it's not that anything in the past ever did, because that was something that was always really important to us. It's got to really resonate. But this felt like, it felt kind of like distilling in a way where we sort of reduced ourselves in order to become more potent, I guess.
Okay, I like that. Did you know going into it, like, how many songs you're going to do or how many EPs would be good? Because was it just going to be one EP in the beginning and then it turned into three, or how did that happen?
No, initially, like, we knew it was going to be more than one. Okay. I didn't know if it was going to be three or four until I had to start doing press around the time of the release of the Timeless EP and the release of the Obsolete single, and people started asking, and I basically on the spot was like, trilogy, boom, three. Trilogy. and at that point we were still working on the second EP, and nothing that was on the third EP was even a thought yet. And that was the other cool thing is, you know, a lot of people ask, you know, did you guys basically write 10 songs and then figure out how to release them? But no, like we released them almost entirely in chronological order that we wrote them, which is almost the chronological order that they appear on the CD, give or take a couple that switched around because of, lyrical themes or whatnot, for just more cohesive listening, I guess. But yeah, it was really nice to sort of just work on things episodically. I guess it would be like a movie director, you know, breaks into television and it's like, okay, well, instead of doing this 2.5 hour long movie, create these, you know, 1.5 hour long episodes. And I think it was a sort of refreshing creative exercise that sort of allowed us to do what we do in the form of, you know, it's all cinematography and it's all writing, but just a different format, you know. And then the conversation with our fans, because music is a way of communicating, you know, it's the universal language, as they say, but language is how you communicate. And so for us, it was really cool to be able to sort of stay very present and connected with the band, very present and connected with each other, as musicians, and also just as you know, as family with each other, mm-hmm. And also with our fans. You know, it was a really, really cool experience. I feel like that was one thing that we really focused on, was we didn't want to lose the connection with people. Mm-hmm. So we just worked as hard as we could to write as many songs as we could. And there's still more new stuff. Basically, as soon as I turned the record in, we were already working on,
really,
on more new music. Yeah, we're always working, because to us, that's the fun part. Like, making mm-hmm. music is the fun part. Touring is fun. Playing shows is fun, but touring is hard. traveling is hard. Getting sick on the road is hard. Mm-hmm. Being away from your family is hard, you know. Being in the studio and working on songs and literally just, you know, it's almost treasure hunting, because you're just trying to uncover that one thing that makes your ears perk up and go, ah, and then you get that, and whatever spark that sort of sparks in you, whatever sort of inspiration that does, you kind of follow that, you know. You're kind of just jumping down rabbit holes and trying to see what's down there, you know. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so we almost always immediately start working, because we're always really inspired when we finish up a project, that we want to take whatever we feel like we've learned from that, and whatever growth we feel like we've experienced or uncovered, or whatever sort of sonic elements we feel like we've used that excite us. Like, we always try and expand on what we're doing, and part of the way that we feel like we can do that in a cohesive way and sort of bridge our records is by starting the process almost immediately, so that, you know, if the songs make the record or not, you have a foundation that sort of acts as a bridge between your past the material records. And whatever you're right. working now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which that's what Obsolete was, which I think that's part of a reason why that connected really well. Our album Earth and Sky connected uh-huh. really well with our fans. And Obsolete's working title was Earth and Sky 2 when Alan sent it over, because the riff kind of follows the same sort of structure, but basically the rest of the song is different. It's basically only that guitar riff that reminded him of it enough to name it that.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, and even stuff like that, you know, it's, we really, really enjoy the process. Like, it's not at all laborious for us to get in the studio and do that. Like, that's, mm-hmm. it is a very tedious process, but we all really enjoy it. Mm-hmm. So we always just kind of start doing that. To us, being in the studio was always the vacation from the rigors of touring. So to sort of have that extended a little bit, and also, you know, it's anytime you start making a living and feeding yourself doing what you love, your relationship with it gets complicated, like more complicated than when it's just a passion project, but it's literally how you pay your bills and whatnot. It gave us something to be focused on that was singularly creative, and then your brain doesn't have all the excess you know, capacity to then worry about everything else. Mm-hmm. If you're just worried about turning in these songs, and you're just worried about working on this one song at a time and this one EP at a time, and then before you know it, the record's out and you're doing press on Zoom.
There you go. And the record's doing awesome. I saw 33 million streams already.
That's crazy.
That is so amazing.
Yeah. And you know, and a lot of that has to do with how we released it, where we didn't really give fans too much of an option, you know, to say, well, here's a bunch of songs, pick your favorite. It was just kind of like, well, here's one song. This is kind of what we want to share with you for now. And we want to have that discussion, you know, have that communication. And in a few weeks, we'll share something else with you. And we kind of just did that throughout the year. You know, we dropped a new song every 4 or 5 weeks, basically, since the start of the year.
Wow.
And it was really cool. It was awesome. I think all of the hardest work of it, in retrospect, doesn't seem that difficult, even though I can remember definitely
it being difficult.
Yeah, it wasn't easy, but, you know, because we were really, really into the whole process, it doesn't feel like it was that hard, even though I know better, even though I know it was very difficult. It doesn't. Now I'm just downplaying it, I guess. Doesn't sound as cool. Yeah.
Well, the record's rad. Do you think you'll self-produce the next body of work?
we currently are, that's really hard to say. If the last couple of years taught me anything, it's don't say always and don't say never. And it's also, you can plan for the next 10 years or you can plan for the next 2 years, but you can't plan for the next 10 minutes. So, if anything, I think what this did was sort of reassure us that if we push comes to shove, we can make a record that connects with our fans with just the four of us. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a reinvigorating feeling. And at the same time, I've even said it, that I don't want it to necessarily be self-limiting to say, well, because this worked, this is what we're going to do from now on. Because that to me can end up becoming just as boring as doing the same thing for seven records before it. So who knows what the record will hold in future.
Well, the current one's amazing.
Who knows what the future has in store, really. Awesome. I certainly don't.
Nor do I, but I appreciate your time, Aaron. This has been awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thanks for talking about the record. And
of course.
Yeah. I have to, if I ever decide to write a memoir, I'm going to need some help because I have a hard time remembering anything.
Well, I think you did awesome. I do have one more quick question. I want to know if you have any advice for aspiring artists.
Just anytime you sit down to work on stuff, remember why you did it the first time. As your dreams and aspirations change, and as you work hard to make them become reality, take the time to sort of sit with yourself and remind yourself, why did I ever write that first song I wrote? Or why did I ever jam with that first band I jammed with? Stay connected with that, because it can get really complicated, especially if you start seeing success and you start, like I said, if it becomes your career, your relationship with it will change. And if you always sort of remind yourself of what music used to do for you back when you were just in the garage with your homies and you would write a riff and they would write a riff and you play them together and it's just awesome. Like, remind yourself of that feeling often. And then when you're sitting down to create, chase that, because that feeling is all the audience wants to connect with. And when you do that, you'll end up with something that, that you don't have to overthink. I guess that was a really long-winded way of saying don't overthink it.